Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with Bob McGinn. Bob, tell us about that song we just heard and why it pertains to you and I in particular.
Last week, Michael, we went to the Meyer Theater in downtown Green Bay.
Yes, we did.
For a sold-out show, probably 1,200, with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Mr. Leon Russell.
Beard included.
73 years old out of Lawton, Oklahoma.
Took the stage with a cane, walked out to the piano, sat down, and played with fingers that you admired how nimble those fingers were, didn't you?
Yeah. In our review of, he played in Milwaukee the night before, our reviewer, Mr. Levy, said that his beard, ZZ Top would have appreciated Leon's beard.
Without question.
How was Leon?
Great. I thought he put on a really good show. I thought the band was really good, too. I thought in particular his guitarist I thought was very good, who also played a little bit of keyboard and synthesizer as well. It was a good show. They played some of their own stuff. They played some of some other people's stuff, and it was fun. It was fun.
He played for about an hour and 25?
Yeah.
No encore.
Well.
What'd he say?
He said, those of you that know me know that I'm not wild about walking, so let's pretend I just walked off the stage and walked back, and I'll play one more for you.
Yeah. The selection we chose was from the Concert for Bangladesh at Madison Square Garden, 1971. And I bought that album, four albums in this thing. George Harrison was the engineer of this operation. And at one point, George introduced him. He said, I want to introduce a friend of us all, Mr. Leon Russell. And then right before this song, George goes, and now a couple numbers from Leon. So he did Jumpin' Jack Flash. I think some of the Stones were there, in fact, at this concert. It was an all-star cast. And Youngblood.
Where was the concert? I can't remember what you told me.
The Garden.
The Garden, okay.
Yep. Great stuff. The grooves on my record were worn off, Mike.
Were they?
Yep.
And you said, when we were talking about it, you said Jumpin' Jack Flash, probably his most famous song, Leon's?
You know, some of the people back then, Rolling Stone magazines, thought he was the highlight of the show.
Really?
And Ringo was there. I mean, it was all-star cast, unbelievable. But he hit that song great. He had a song, Lady Blue, I believe, that he sang.
Yeah, he played that when we were there.
Yeah. He's just more of a... He toured with Jerry Lee Lewis at age 14. He kind of insinuated a little bit of those when he started young.
And he played on some bands for other albums that you might not know unless you've read, you know, the inside package to see who was on the band. But what was it, the Wrecking Crew, Spoon was telling us?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just a popular studio band for some of the greatest artists of all time in the rock industry.
He's just done a little bit of everything, Mike. Producer, writer, session guy. Singer, he's been in the business forever, and he's still making new albums, new music all the time.
What'd you think of his voice? I thought it was all right. It held up okay.
Now, when you compare it to the voice here,
yeah.
45 years ago, it's a difference. But I thought it was solid.
Yeah, and his piano skills seemed as good as ever. It was fun.
Wouldn't you like to be a rocker, Mike?
Yeah, I actually was just having a conversation with one of my friends, and at some point, maybe today after we record this podcast, I have to show you some of the footage from the band I was in with my friends when I was in high school. We were very good. We were one of the best high school bands in the state of Connecticut. We were the best high school band in the state of Connecticut for 2 years in a row, I think. And we got offered to be an opening act for some group and tour up and down the East Coast, and our parents said no way because we would have to stop school.
Wow.
But we always wonder, and I just texted the guitarist in our little band this morning, and I said, you know, hey, if you could choose between being a pro athlete or if we could have made it big and toured nationwide, what would you have chosen? And he said, well, it's tough. He said, but I think I might go athlete. So
yeah.
What do you think, Bob? If you could have been a pro quarterback or if you could be somebody, you know, in the uppermost annals of rock and roll, what would you have rather done?
Rock and roll.
Okay.
My son-in-law, you know, is a rocker, and my daughter's a singer and all this. And so I like talking to him. When I see him, all we do is talk music, man.
Yeah.
I just want to learn about all this stuff. And It just seemed like such a rush on that stage, I'm telling you.
If you had played an instrument, is there anything you would have wanted to play? Mm. Besides drums, I always wanted to play saxophone.
I never even thought of that.
Really?
I have no musical talent of anything. I'm tone deaf. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, so Saturday night, what did we do?
Saturday night, we went up to University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, my first trip over to the campus. And in return for going to the concert, I dragged you out to a soccer game in the freezing cold weather. It was really cold. And we watched, who did they play?
The Oakland Golden Grizzlies.
The Golden Grizzlies. And we both saw the game with the Grizzlies winning ahead of time. And we both ended up being right. It was 1-0 Golden Grizzlies.
1-0, huh?
1-0. Good job, Bob.
And so I learned a lot about soccer that night, Mike. I asked you question after question, all kinds of stuff.
Yes, just
alignments,
like
formations,
my
strategy.
First few days of training camp here with the Packers.
Tactics. That was fun.
It was a lot of fun.
But we did not last the entire game.
And we didn't. We left at halftime, and you went home, and well, Bob watched the Michigan game and enjoyed it.
I watched a certain game.
But then what did we do on Sunday? We saw a quarterback throw the heck out of the ball, didn't we, Bob? Philip Rivers and the Chargers in a losing effort. I have to say, you know, I haven't been to a lot of pro games. I've been to a ton of college games. But that performance by Rivers was one of the best I've seen.
You know, we talked about Dan Fouts last week on this podcast, the
yes,
game here in 84. And it was reminiscent of that. Kellen Winslow caught 15 balls. Keenan Allen caught 14 in 64 snaps out of 92. Who knows? Would he have broken Brandon Marshall's NFL record of 21?
I don't know if he gets to 21. I think he would have finished with around 18, 19.
I'm saying 22.
22, wow. I mean, he certainly would have broke Winslow's record without question.
They were helpless against him.
Helpless.
Hopeless.
And it didn't matter who was on him either.
No,
Shields,
five, six guys.
Randall, Hayward, didn't matter.
Nope, it didn't. Keenan Allen, the all-time record at Green Bay. Against Green Bay, Tom Fears, Hall of Famer, L.A. Rams, 1950, Mike.
Okay.
A 65-year-old record. He caught 18 balls.
He's only a third-year player, but when you were talking to scouts last week about the Chargers, were they enamored with Allen, or was this more of a fluky craziness?
They liked him. They said he was, but they did say he was a number two. You know, he's only a 4-5-5 guy. But then Thursday, when I was talking to Joe Witt, I was asking about Antonio Gates.
Defensive backs coach for the Packers, Joe Witt. Yeah.
Cornerbacks. Yeah.
Cornerbacks coach, sorry.
Right. But then he said, what about 13? And I says, yeah, that's Allen. And he just went off.
Really?
He said he really knew very little about Allen before he was preparing for the game. After studying him and preparing for him, he thought he was as good a route runner as there is in the league as Larry Fitzgerald, who
wow.
is his number one in that category. He thought he was tremendous. And I'm sure he told his players, obviously, all week long, but they couldn't handle him.
Now, we were both obviously impressed by what Rivers did, but I know you wrote about it for the paper. Specifically, you talked about his quick release and some of the things he was doing there. What do you think enabled Rivers to have so much success against a defense that had played lights out the last couple weeks before the game?
Well, and he did it with three backup offensive linemen.
Yeah.
But you got to say, those offensive linemen, they worked their ass off.
No question.
On his behalf. You know, when you got a quarterback like that, it inspires these backups to higher effort. And they battled. I mean, Mike Daniels was pushing people back, and, you know, Guyon's got some of that, and there was pressure off the edge. But they formed that cup, which, as we discussed, the scouts said that they would try to do. And they kept it free. But he kept getting the ball out so fast, Mike.
I think that was a big thing, too, because it's hard for an outside backer to get all the way to the quarterback in 2-3 seconds. And sometimes he was getting the ball off in less than a second.
Like J. Rowan Elliott, I said, do you believe the way he just seemed to be, he knew every one of Dom's calls. And he says, did he sleep here last night or something? Elliott says that, you know. He was just on top of everything, calling screens against six-man pressures. I mean, he had all these things just ready to go.
Well, I don't know if you noticed this, Bob, when you were watching the tape, but there were two or three times in a row in the second half where before the snap, Rivers yelled, "Cross dog, cross dog," indicating that the two inside backers were going to both blitz but twist so that they would go on either side of each other. And he was right three times in a row. And it was weird because the first time it happened, it was after Matthews moved to outside backer. So they had Palmer and Thomas in the middle. And he called, "Cross dog, cross dog." And Palmer and Thomas kind of looked at each other like, should we still do it? Like, do we audible? Do we change? And they blitzed anyway. And, you know, Rivers threw, I can't remember if he threw the ball away or he threw an incompletion, a completion rather. But, you know, the blitz didn't matter. And he did it two or three times in a row. I made note of it in my pad. I couldn't believe it. I've never seen a guy call out the act. I mean, you can recognize a blitz, but to call it out without getting the guys to jump or anything.
Yeah.
Something about it. He was on fire.
503. That's 48 yards more than he's ever thrown in a game in 12 years. 65 attempts, that was 11 more, and 43 completions, I believe it was 5 more than he ever had before. 92 plays, 72 gradable dropbacks. It took forever watching this tape. Thank you, Philip.
Oh, man, it was something. It was something. I thought his quote after the game was pretty telling, too. I don't have it exactly in front of me, but someone asked him, you know, what do you think of this game as a whole? And he said, oh, man, you know, I really don't know. And then this is the part that stuck with me. You have to laugh just to stop from crying.
TJ Lang said, people say Aaron's got a quick release. I don't think anybody has a quicker release than that guy. He played a hell of a game. Boy, isn't that true, huh? He really did play a hell of a game.
Yes,
but
he did.
But they got beat. They got beat because so much of this game is red zone oriented, Mike.
Yeah, and that was the biggest problem. You know, they moved the ball. Gosh, I don't have the numbers again in front of me, but I think they had 6 drives of 30 yards or more, and they put 20 points on the board. And it was 4 drives of, was it 4 drives of 60 or more or 4 drives of 70? I can't exactly remember. But, man, did they have... They moved the ball at will, and but then, just like we saw in the last possession of the game, they were stonewalled. And I know you wrote about those last few plays. When you wrote about it at first, and then when you went back and watched them, what did you make of the goal line stand there by the Packers at the end?
Kind of unreal. You know, to me, because they were just trying to force overtime, they wouldn't have gone for it. It's not quite as stunning as when it would have won the game, you know? The Packers won an opening game here in 2011, the first kickoff game against New Orleans, when New Orleans was inside the one, but it was a 4 or 5 point game, you know, and they piled up Mark Ingram and won the game. And this is a little bit different because it's not sudden death, but still. The first down, Matthews beat that block over there. He didn't really beat a block. He just kind of, he just kind of felt the blocking combinations and where Woodhead was coming, and then he just arrived and stacked him up for a gain of 1. It was terrific play. Second down. All right, so it ended up Rivers overthrowing Gates in the right corner. Now, he's got Woodhead, obviously the same combination as they had on fourth down. Woodhead's open, right? Randall was too far back on the thing.
And it looked like he may have been able to take off up the middle, too. There was so much room in the middle of the field. Nobody was there.
He's so slow, Mike, I don't think he would have made it.
Okay.
I remember exactly what you're talking about. I don't think he would have made it. But, all right, so Rivers threw to the corner, and he threw high. That was against Hyde, and then Randall sucking back. It's a very common route combination in the red zone. And okay, third down, Dayton Jones, whose weakness is run defense, beats DJ Fluker, a 325-pound mauler. He beats him a bit of a backdoor move inside and stuffs Woodhead for -1. How about that play?
It was impressive. I thought Dayton played pretty well throughout the game. He had a couple other moments as well.
He's had 2 good games in a row.
Yes, he has.
All right. So
and congratulations to him for the birth of his child, by the way.
You got it.
Happened on Thursday? Wednesday before the game? I can't remember. But anyway, he missed practice one day, and it was because his wife gave birth to their child. So congratulations to Dayton.
Couldn't name her after a better Muhammad Ali in there, huh?
Yeah, Layla, right?
Yep. Okay, so now fourth down. So Aaron Rodgers in his presser, a very interesting remark. When he saw the second down play and he saw Woodhead open, he kind of thought, wow, I wonder if they're going to go back to that. And they did. There was a stoppage of play, a timeout, I believe. They had all the time in the world. And Frank Reich and Mr. Rivers came up with this, and Mike McCoy. Matthews kind of really sort of made the play by holding. He risked a penalty, but he kind of held Gates coming off that line. It wasn't a jam. It was really a hold. I mean, he kind of made the play. He eliminated Gates.
Which meant Randall could cheat closer to Woodhead.
Correct.
Right. And Caper said on Monday when he spoke to us after the game that Randall's role in that zone coverage is to put himself in a position where he can play either Gates or Woodhead, depending on where the ball goes.
I had a perfect angle. My seat in the press box enabled me to have a perfect line between Rivers and Woodhead. And I had my binoculars up on this play. Usually I don't because I'm looking at formations and things. But on this one I did. So I saw this unfold perfectly. And he kind of hitched. And he hitched and kind of held on that delivery because of pressure from Julius Peppers, right?
Yep.
He bull rushed Mr. Barksdale. He got a knockdown on the play. Rogers ended up down
Rivers.
Rivers put as much as he possibly could into that throw. Now let's go to Demaryius Randall. What did he do?
So Demaryius breaks toward the corner pylon of the end zone, dives, lays out, knocks the ball away, and gets up screaming his head off, running the other way.
What reaction?
It was incredible. Great play.
I mean, what can you say?
And you wanted to play Rollins a few weeks ago.
Gosh. Rollins did not look good in this game.
No, he did not.
So they win it 27-20. Outgained, you could maybe say outplay, but not out red zoned. And it's how you win games. Mike McCarthy does not lose as an underdog.
And no, as a favorite, right?
Yeah. Right.
So another interesting aspect of the game that everybody was talking about afterwards was what was going on in the backfield. We had Eddie Lacy, the team's starter and who has been the starter, who didn't start. And James Starks was out there for the first snap. He finished with over 100 yards, broke the first carry for 25, broke a 65-yard run for a touchdown later in the game when he spun off the back of John Kuhn and into open field on the right-hand side. After the game, everyone said, "What's up with Lacy? What's up with Lacy?" He swore that his ankle, which he injured earlier in the season, was fine. He said it wasn't an issue. Stark said he didn't know of anything wrong with Lacy. And McCarthy basically just said that they really want this to be a 1-2 punch, even though the statistical breakdown in terms of carries between Lacy and Starks has never been an even 1-2 punch over the years. So, Bob, what did you make of, first of all, what did you think of Starks and the way he played? And then second, what do you think was the issue with Lacy?
Starks was my player of the game, the 25 run, the 65 run, the 5 shovel for the touchdown. He was the player of the game. When you watch that tape, let's go to the first play of the game. And, you know, teams have openers, and these play callers, Clements, McCarthy, Bennett, Aaron Rodgers, they dote on your first play. In high school football, we did the same thing, Mike. I think everybody does that. You want that first play to really send a message, you know? You want it to be successful. All right, so they're going to run that toss play off right tackle that they've had good mileage on this season. All right, when you look at that play, it's a 25-yard gain and tremendously well blocked. The reach block by 63, laying on the linebacker, a Balaga shoving somebody outside, a really excellent lead by 82, the tight end, on Perryman, an impressive young backer who's trying to run through on the thing. All right, but still, you got Eric Weddle, a really good free safety, coming from the backside. And at that break point, which is 6 yards downfield, he takes a glancing blow to Starks' left leg. Starks withstands it and goes for 25. Now, you're doing your openers. Do you want Lacy on the field for that play, or do you want Starks? Does Lacy get there in time to avoid a frontal shot from Weddle? I wrote in that thing the other day, I said, probably not, that Starks is the man to run that play. Now, what's interesting, Mike, Starks then left the lineup. Okay, maybe he was a little gassed, but normally 25-yard run, you're right back in the huddle. He was out then for 6 plays in a row. So they immediately went to Lacy as if he's the starter. But They wanted Starks on that first play. So I'm not really sure what's going on. Because later, now the snap counts were 28 Starks, 20 for Lacy, so plus 8. But yet Lacy, he had that fumble in which Denzel Perryman, boy, does he look good. Holy cow, from the kid from Miami, the 5'11 inside backer. He knocked a ass over tea kettle. I mean, the ball's going one way. He's flying another way. It's a horrible thing for Lacy. He's getting knocked back by this 5'11 guy. So that didn't help his playing time after that either.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely interesting to see the way it played out. And, you know, like I said, immediately everyone went to the ankle, and the coaches said he was banged up, and, you know, the coordinator said the same thing on Monday. But, you know, Lacy swore that he was fine and said it wasn't an issue and that, you know, he's happy for Starks and he likes to see, you know, what the offense can look like with Starks doing really well and then Lacy playing, you know, better in certain games up to his potential. But the whole thing just kind of seems weird to me. I mean, I know he had the fumble, but I think he only had 4 carries for the whole game and 2 catches, and it was just, it was odd. It was odd.
So a couple personnel people in the last couple weeks have said that they think, one guy said Lacy's between 260 and 270, and another guy's thought around 260. Now, he's listed at 240. However, you know, he was listed at, I think, 229 or 232 by the Packers initially. And then they upped that to 240 about a year ago. I think it was the summer of 2014. I have no idea what he weighs. Eddie doesn't discuss that. He's been asked many times. Is he bigger this year than last year? Some people say he is. I don't really know what's the truth.
I don't either. But I tell you one thing. He looks like a massive man in the locker room.
Do you think he's closer to 260 than 240?
Oh, yeah. Without question, I think so. Yeah.
I guess I would agree. But our colleague, what does our colleague think?
If you look at him next to Alonzo Harris, who's 232?
No, 238, 240.
Okay, if you look at him next to Harris, obviously their heights are different. But, I mean, he looks so much wider than Harris in the thigh, in the stomach. I think he's a huge man right now. Our colleague Tom Silverstein said that he thought he was closer in the 240, 245 range.
He might be right.
He could be. He certainly could be. But I would just, my bet leans closer to 260.
Is he in shape? The coaches have said he's in great shape.
Yeah.
McCarthy has said that. They've always said that.
Yeah.
We don't know if that's true. We don't see him run gassers or anything like that. I don't know.
You used to run gassers back in the day in high school, Bob?
Yeah, and they used to run them here in Green Bay, too.
Really?
That 53-yard wide field back and forth after practice. McCarthy outlawed. I mean, all these coaches did that in Green Bay. McCarthy's done away with all that because of the tempo at practice.
We used to call them suicides in soccer. And what we would do is we would use the length of a soccer field. Wow. So what you do is first you run from one end line to the 6-yard box, then back to the end line, then the 18-yard, then back to the end line, then the circle, then back to the end line, then half, and so on. Hmm. So you end up running what's about, you know, 4 full soccer fields.
Wow.
And you got to do it as fast as you can. All out sprint.
Basketball players, we always run the lines.
Yep.
Free throw, middle, opposite free throw, end of it. Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so that's Lacy.
All right, now one other thing we wanted to touch on from this game was what you wrote your Sunday column about, which was some similarities between Clay Matthews, now an inside linebacker for the Packers, and one of the best inside linebackers, you know, certainly in the last 30 years, but maybe ever, in Junior Seau. What, first of all, how'd you come up with the idea for this column, Bob?
Just because the Chargers were in town.
Okay.
You know? And I guess the biggest similarity to me is just the way they manhandle and demolish people. Throwing them down, just flicking them aside. There was even a little evidence of Matthews doing that in this game, and I thought, yep, that's what I'm talking about. Seau did the same thing, just grabbing running backs by the, what's the word, nape of the neck?
Pretty much.
Back of the neck, yeah. Just pinwheeling them down into the dirt. when I was telling Matthews about this, yeah, he knew it. He says, yeah, I'll take that. Hey, I've got a job to do. If you're getting in the way, so be it. I mean, he was yucking it up on that. That physicality, that intimidation, that punishing style that I just love, and a lot of it's being legislated out of the league. But that kind of stuff, I've always just doted on, you know. And I'm kind of an old-fashioned purist in this football stuff, and it comes down to hitting people, man, and, you know, kicking ass. That's what football's all about. It really is. And you can't get around it. And that's what Matthews, he does. And I think it inspires his teammates, fans. I think it intimidates the opposition. So, and then I just went on from there and talking about Seau's career, talking to people who knew both of them.
Now, I've obviously never seen Seau in person. How many times did you think you got to see him play over the years?
One Super Bowl in person. I was around him during those interviews that week when they got drilled by the Niners. And what, three games against Green Bay ever?
Okay.
I think that's about it. When he was in Miami for 3 years, they never played the Packers. When he was in New England, he played one game against the Packers. I do remember that. They killed the Packers at Lambeau, one of McCarthy's first years.
Even in those small sample sizes, could you see some of the things that you were talking about?
Oh, yeah. It was hard to take my eyes off him in those games, Mike. You'd just be sitting there with those eyes like Mike Singletary in Chicago used to. And, you know, that old-fashioned middle backer. He's a 4-3 will, but kind of stacked behind the line and just, you know, hunched over, hands on knees, legs, knees bent, you know, just looking awesome and menacing and marauding and just destroying people.
So what were some of the things that you found most interesting when you talked to certain people that were familiar with both guys?
Well, Dale Lindsay is a guy who covered the Packer linebackers in 86, 87 under Forrest Gregg. And then he coached Seau as his position coach his third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh years. And then he came back to San Diego for his final year as a D coordinator. And he was Brian Urlacher's position coach for 2 years in Chicago, his first 2 years. And Lindsay spent a lifetime in football. He played linebacker for the Cleveland Browns for 9 years in the 60s and 70s. Still head coach at University of California at University of San Diego, the Toreros.
Yeah, the Fighting Toreros, who we don't speak of in Connecticut because one time as a number 13 seed in the NCAA tournament, they knocked out the Huskies.
The Toreros,
yep. I'll never forget that game. I watched it live after school one day. I was probably in middle school or maybe a freshman in high school, and it was embarrassing.
You were that was a stunner.
Oh, yeah. The Huskies were a good team that year. Anyway.
So Dale just, he's seen a lot of Matthews on TV. You know, he's never seen him in person, I don't think. But he knows linebackers and, you know, different styles. I mean, he went on about Junior, but he thought, you know, their leadership, their work ethic. He just knows about Matthews. He knows played against the dad, coached against the dad. He knows the family, and he thought there was that intangible element.
Now, how about, I know you got to speak with Clay. When you first sort of brought up to him the idea of the comparison, was it one that he had heard before? Was he floored by it? What did you kind of gauge his reaction to be?
Yeah, he had never heard it, he said, and he was honored and floored by it, yeah. And so he heard, you know, he was listening to my comparisons, and he said, I haven't really studied much about Seau. He said, I really wasn't into watching the NFL until, like, my junior year in college when I thought playing in the league was a realistic possibility. I think he's probably curious now, and he might go back and watch some tape of Seau. I wouldn't be surprised.
When we were at your house last week recording the podcast, as I was putting the music in and mixing everything together, I know you were watching some Seau highlights on YouTube. Boy, that guy can hit, huh?
Yeah, he could really hit.
Especially when you put together those packages, which are obviously some of his best plays ever. But when you watch him back to back to back to back, it was kind of remarkable, some of the stuff he could do.
Ran 4.65, weighed 250 at the end. Nasty. Just rip people, you know.
And you had an actual scouting report, didn't you, on Seau?
Yeah, I did. Dick Corrick, Corrick, a former Packer head of their personnel department, and then he scouted for many years, lived in Green Bay, passed away about 7-8 years ago. I had his report, and Dick was there at his pro day. I think it was more of an individual workout than a pro day, maybe, in 1990. And he thought he gave him a Pro Bowl grade. And Dick used the word has throw off strength, and that's what I think we're talking about with both these players, the ability to grab somebody and just, what word, I keep using the word dismiss, demolish, trash.
Dispose.
Yeah, dispose of. I like it. Yeah. Pure speed, some nasty, fine body control, and real ease of movement. I can see Dick saying that. Great kid, eager and cooperative. And, you know, initially he was a defensive end. He played a lot of end at USC senior year. He had 18 or 19 sacks. And then he tried to play down in San Diego. But then when Dale Lindsey took over, Dale said it was a tough sell because he really wanted to play with his hand down. But Dale also said, and somebody else did too, that he was not a classic pass rusher. He did not work his hands well, and he just didn't have that intricate footwork that once you get abreast or a stride of a guy, the tackle, you have to, like, turn your feet and angle your feet to get an angle to the quarterback. He just couldn't do that. He didn't have a limited arsenal, too small to bull rush. And after they really, George O'Leary was the D-line coach then. He's head coach at UCF, I believe.
Correct, yep.
And they convinced Sale that there was money to be made at backer, and as Dale said, the rest is history. It was fun talking to these guys.
Definitely a really unique story. So if you haven't seen it yet, go back and check it out. It's on our website. And while you're there, take a look at another piece that Bob had from last week that was kind of interesting on the connections between the Packers and Steve Spurrier. Where were you going with this one, Bob?
I talked to Wolf about Junior Seau and Clay Matthews. And then he brings up, he says, a great football man retired today. I said, Spurrier? He goes, yeah. And then he just went off. And I had never heard this before. He said, yeah, I tried to hire him twice. He was going to give him the job. If he got the go-ahead from Spurrier,
head coach,
Green Bay Packers, after Holmgren left in January of 99, Spurrier would have had the job. After Wolf fired Ray Rhodes after 1 year, if Spurrier wanted the job, he'd call him again. He would have had the job, flat. Bob Harlan wouldn't intervene. I mean, after all Wolf's success, Bob would have just gone along with it. The executive committee would have gone with it. Steve Spurrier would have been in Green Bay coaching Brett Favre. How about that, Mike?
Pretty cool. Did he say why he declined?
Yeah, he thought it was just the lifestyle in Green Bay and Wisconsin. You know, he wanted to be near the beach, according to Wolf. He loved playing golf year round. Now, he didn't have that in Washington, but better weather than here. Dan Snyder made him the highest paid coach in the NFL when he did decide to make that jump in 02. I'd like to talk to Spurrier. I couldn't reach him. That'd be really fun. He was on game day on TV Saturday from Ann Arbor. I don't know much about Spurrier. I've never dealt with him, never spoken to him, but based on all this stuff Wolf said, he thinks he's a complete icon, a coaching legend. He thinks his team's had a lot more than just cutting-edge offense. He talked about discipline and toughness. I think Spurrier's bluntness appealed to Wolf because that's the kind of guy Wolf is. When Wolf was GM of the Buccaneers, that winless first season in 76, Spurrier was his quarterback, so he knew the guy from there. I was kind of taken aback by it.
And Zook worked with him at Florida. Yeah, he was a special teams coordinator for him, and then I think he had a couple other positions as well.
Yep. And Ron didn't really, when I talked to Ron, he didn't really think that the NFL was Spurrier's cup of tea. Just the rigors and the pressures and all that kind of stuff. So Spurrier went back to South Carolina after Washington and had a lot of success.
He did?
Boy.
Definitely did. One of the definitely, I think, will go down as one of the best college coaches ever. You think?
I think so.
I agree.
I mean, I saw some of his teams play with Tebow and I guess national title games, but did you pay much attention to Florida football in those years?
Well, I used to watch him a little bit more because Aaron Hernandez, who obviously everyone knows from the legal trouble that he got in, he grew up one town over from me, and so I was familiar with him. Aaron and I actually went to basketball camp together. We were at the same camp for like 3 or 4 years in a row. So I played against him. You know, he ran track as well, and I was on the track team. We didn't run the same events, but, you know, I was on the team when he would be there and stuff. Mm. So I always kind of watched him because I was interested in this guy who grew up, you know, 15 minutes from my house. So I was familiar with him a little bit more than some. But those were more Urban Meyer teams than anything else, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't really watch a whole lot of Spurrier.
Oh, you're right, too. Yeah, I didn't
think of that. Those were Urban Meyer teams.
Right, I didn't think of it. Yep.
Yep.
So 8-17 at Florida.
Win percentage?
Yeah, 122-27-1.
That's not bad.
And as Wolf said, Florida had really never done anything.
No. He changed the whole the AD for Florida, Jeremy Foley, said when Spurrier retired last week that he changed the entire expectation and everything for the whole school. I believe, if I remember correctly, the quote from Foley said that when Foley first got to Florida, the expectation was to try and win one SEC game, and then it became to win national titles.
Would he have been successful in Green Bay? He would have taken over a really good team in 99. He had Brett Favre. He had Dorsey Levens. He still had Leroy Butler.
Edgar Bennett.
Edgar, not yet.
Not yet?
Edgar came in 2001 draft,
okay.
Yeah, from Florida State. You got to think he would have been very successful.
Oh, yeah. I think Favre would have worked well in that air raid.
Wolf would have had to give him the players. He knew nothing about scouting, and he would have had to, but Wolf would have had the power, and he would have had to acquiesce.
Good word.
He brought nine guys. Nine of his 16 coaches had never coached in the NFL before, eight of whom off from his Florida staff. I don't think Wolf would have ever permitted that. Never. He might have given him two or three, but that wouldn't have flown. Wolf would have stopped that. That would have been a professional NFL staff. There would have been some of the leftovers from Holmgren maybe would have stayed rather than go to Seattle. They would have had a good staff. Wolf would have, his hand-picked coach, he would have gotten that guy players. They would have kept winning. Yep. Super Bowls, who knows, but they would have kept winning.
All right, let's see what else do we have on our agenda today. Well, we want to get into two kind of little newsy items here. The retirement of Jermichael Finley.
Yeah, you wrote something this week about it, right?
Yeah, we came across ESPN. I think it said that his agent had spoken to Adam Schefter or something like that. But, you know, obviously I never covered Jermichael, but what are your kind of his impressions of his time here? Finished with, I think, 20 touchdowns in his career for the Packers,
yeah.
I think it was.
Played
in six seasons. Yeah,
so
six
it's
seasons.
Over, huh? Boy,
yeah.
I mean, a young guy came out. Was he a third-year sophomore? I don't know. Just a young player.
Oklahoma, right?
No.
No?
Texas.
I thought it was Oklahoma.
No, Texas. Maybe just Texas. He came out the same year as Martellus Bennett.
You're right, Texas. I'm
Texas.
Wrong. Yep.
And Martellus Bennett was
A&M.
A&M. Yep.
Yeah.
So he was just a young kid. He didn't know anything about how to be a pro or work habits, really. But, you know, McCarthy, many times he's said that this guy enlivened practice. He wished everybody would practice like Finley. The guy really became a hard-working pro. Now, he dropped a lot of balls, and he wasn't a great blocker, but he gave them that vertical threat that they've never replaced. I mean, you know, these current tight ends can't hold a candle to him in terms of this downfield passing game, stretching a defense. Boy, could they use him now, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things you mentioned, I think, is really key. When I was talking to tight ends coach Jerry Fontenot about Kennard Backman and sort of some of the things they could do in his development to try and speed up the process and things, he said that he'd been showing Kennard a lot of film of Jermichael and said that, you know, when it came to the nastiness, the I think reckless abandon was the phrase that he used. He said that's what he would like to see more of from some of his guys, because when Jermichael went out there, he played like a banshee, basically.
Yeah, he did. He played hard. You know, these flat passes you see, whether they're boots or just kind of delays you see from 82 Richard Rodgers, almost never breaks a tackle. Finley was getting these flats in his later years. 50% of the time, he would break that low tackle. He had a great low block shield with his hands. He kept his head up, his eyes up. You just keep going, man, down the sideline.
And we've seen Richard Rodgers cut down by a lot of DBs in those situations, which is surprising because Rodgers plays at 270. What did Finley play at? Do you remember roughly?
Yeah, he put on a lot of weight over the years. I'd say at the end, 255.
Okay, so still a guy with, you know, 15 more pounds than Rodgers and significantly bigger gap than that compared to Finley's younger years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rodgers can't seem to break those tackles.
I know it's a bogus thing to say, all these guys on TV, you know, or radio, whenever somebody leaves, you know, it's the cliche, wish him well. This is a player I can truthfully say I do wish him well. I like him.
Do you remember what was going through your mind the game when he was down on the field and couldn't move his body?
Like, I don't.
You don't remember?
No.
It was against who I can't even remember who it was against.
There's so many injuries, Mike, over these years. I can't remember the particulars.
Yeah, I just remember looking at the photo. It was on our website of him down on the field, you know, basically motionless, and then Corliss is like standing over him, you know, and you can just kind of tell that Corliss senses something is wrong. Which is just sort of a powerful photo when I looked at it.
So,
hopefully everything turns out well for JerMichael. I think if I remember correctly, he's coaching in Texas now.
Really?
I think he's involved with a high school program. Mm. I think his Twitter profile said that. He tweets about it all the time.
Hmm.
And then we've got one other news item. The Packers lost a player to the Bears.
Yeah, on Saturday, the Bears dipped into the Packer practice squad, and they signed Bruce Gaston, the defensive lineman. He'll go into the Bears 3-4 and try to give Vic Fangio some inside pass rush, replaces D lineman Ego Ferguson, who went on IR.
And he was active the very first game.
Was he really?
That's what Spoon said, yeah. Active against the Lions.
What'd you think of Gaston this summer?
I liked him. You know, I think, first of all, I thought he was great to talk to, you know, just a really good guy. But in terms of the way he played, I liked his motor, you know. I thought he was relentless. I thought he was quick for his size. He's a big man, too, but I liked his quickness. And, you know, remember, this is a guy that was on the active roster for the Packers and played in a couple games. It was just the return of, was it Guy? No. When did they move him? Because Guyon took Corliss's spot, but when did Aberderis. That's what it was.
Right.
They released Gaston to make room for Aberderis when it was clear that Davante Adams was not going to be able to play. And then they re-signed Gaston to the practice squad. But the point of that was that this is not a practice squad only guy. This is a guy that contributed for the Packers and played in the active roster.
So it's interesting. You know, the Bears took Gaston over Christian Ringo. Same player, basically. He's shorter, but it's the interior pass rush dimension that makes both attractive. I think it's a player the Packers didn't really want to lose.
Agreed.
Would they rather have Gaston under their control or Aberderis? Their decision is Aberderis.
Mm-hmm.
Gaston's a pretty good player. That's why he's been on five teams.
I think he's a good player too.
Yeah. So he's gone to the Bears and he's going to play. Yeah. All right.
And then the practice squad obviously got revamped a little bit. They signed Perillo to the active roster, and then Mitchell Henry came on, and Mr. Sabetic from Kenosha Tremper, right?
Yes.
He's back.
Melvin Gordon's from Bradford.
Right,
he's back.
Sabetic's a decent little player.
I like him. Yeah, he's versatile. They only got 9 practice squatters right now, Mike.
Is that true?
That's all I got.
Okay. Well, then they've got a spot open.
The Pack's one light. Who do we go with? Maybe Gene Fanor comes back. They liked him. He's a pretty good safety, old Gene.
I'm trying to think.
Glover Wright's somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah, I believe so. Who else could they go with? They do like to tend to bring back guys that they've had in camp before, right?
That's the Packer way.
Okay.
How about Vinny Kowalski from Villanova?
No.
No. Pink, if he come back from his injury?
That could be possible.
That's Larry Pinkard. Garth Gerhart just got waived off Cleveland's practice squad.
Okay. Well, that's a good question. I don't know. We'll have to see. All right. Now let's move on to something here. I notice an older newspaper clip in front of me back when the pages were wider and the color was non-existent. And what do we got here, Bob? This is October 16th, 1984. So this was a Monday night game.
It was, yeah. This is 1 week after we blabbed last week about the San Diego, Dan Fouts, Kellen Winslow game in Green Bay. So then 8 days later, the Pack went out to Denver to play another AFC West club at Denver. Monday night, October 15th. I remember this. Snow started falling about an hour before the game.
Okay.
We were walking in. Snow's coming down. Eventually, 3 inches of this thick, heavy snow fell. The whole game was played in snow. The Pack now coming off that tough, tough defeat against Denver. They're 1-5. Denver's en route to a 13-3 season.
Wow.
The Bronx, Dan Reeves, the coach, only favored by 6.
Okay.
At Mile High. Mike, old Mile High, it's a lot better than new Mile High. This place was classic. Loud. Holy man, was it loud. Just a good old place, you know. Love that joint. The Pack is 1-5 in Denver. They won overtime pass from Favre to Jennings in 07. Prior to that, they had lost their 5 appearances. All right, so 3 inches of snow, it falls. This game starts. Dan Reeves wins the toss, and he wants to play defense. And nobody in those days, everybody received. Every level of football, receive, receive, receive. Just, you know, it was a no-brainer. Then all analytics came in, I guess. Green Bay, first play on their own 28. Joe Collier, the cagey Bronco D coordinator, who gave me a great interview on the Super Bowl book about all those terrible Super Bowl defeats. He shifts the line. The Packers don't adjust. Gary Ellis, the running back. I saw Gary Ellis sing Ray Charles this summer at a Green Bay band concert.
I don't really know what to make of that.
He was great.
Okay.
He really did the job.
I believe you.
Wow. Okay, Gary decides to bend this play outside against this screwed-up blocking combo. Tommy Jackson, small pygmy linebacker, drills him. Ball goes flying. Picked up by free safety Steve Foley. Touchdown, 22-yard return. Pack gets the ball back. First or second play, the fullback, Jesse Clark. He fumbles. Cornerback Louis Wright picks it up. 27-yard return. It's 14-0. The final, Mike, Denver wins it 17-14.
Okay.
This is an unforgettable game. The Pack, in that snow, Lynn Dickey was 27 of 37 for 371.
Not bad.
The Hall of Famer, James Lofton, 11 for 206.
Okay.
Against a cornerback like Louis Wright, Pro Bowler about 8 times. Green Bay gains 423. The Bronx, 193 under Elway. 10 first downs. The Pack has 25. Mike, how did they lose this game? Well, the 2 fumbles didn't help.
Yeah.
But also, Green
Sounds
Bay,
like the Chargers and the Packers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Green Bay's first 7 possessions, of their first 7, they went to the Denver 11, 44, 40, 19, 29, 6, and 20 without scoring.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Fumbles, turnovers.
That's what, 4 trips to the red zone and an additional trip to the 29-yard line, 0 points.
Nice.
Not good.
They had a bit of a kicking problem that day.
Okay.
Mr. Eddie Garcia. Forrest, as soon as he got the job, he traded away Jan Stenerud, the Hall of Fame kicker for the Chiefs, who had had 2 or 3 great years in Green Bay. I don't know why Forrest did that. He was old, but so what? He trades him to the Vikings for a 7th.
Okay.
After this game, I went up to Lofton. I was asking him about that trade because after what his replacement did, and Lofton said, well, we got a 7th-round pick. He said, I bet we get it. He smirks. He says, we're going to get a hell of a player, aren't we? Eddie Garcia that night missed from 29. He missed from 37. That made him 3 for 9 for the year. 2 days later, Forrest stuck him on IR and signed Al Del Greco, who did well for 3 or 4 years.
Was that an open-air press box?
No.
No, okay.
No. Okay, about the snow, Mike. Little Philip Epps, a wide receiver for Green Bay, he stopped fielding all these punts by the second quarter. Looking up into this fog, thick, swirling snow, he just let him, he didn't even try.
Okay.
Larry McCarron, who grew up in Illinois, played high school ball, played the Fighting Illini there. Speaking of Larry, when Larry played high school basketball in suburban Chicago, you know who his assistant coach at the school was? Steve Fisher. Led Michigan to an NCAA title.
Okay, that's still Steve Fisher. I was thinking
State.
Football. Yep,
yeah.
Yep. Embroiled in NCAA scandal. A fine Michigan man.
That was Bill Frieder.
Well, I'm saying right now, Fisher has NCAA
he?
Problems
at San Diego State.
Everywhere he's been.
Here's what Forrest said afterwards. Denver's offense scored 3 points, and Green Bay's offense scored 28. 14 for Denver and 14 for us. That's about the size of it. Ron Hallstrom, the quotable guard, said, "Can you believe that? We killed ourselves. They didn't beat us." Elway did nothing. It was a brutal defeat, and it's one that, you know, a lot of people remember. Mike Douglas, as he was leaving, he said, "I never thought I'd see the day. This possibly could have been a shutout," he said disgustedly. I guess that's it. So, well, here's one other little vignette from that game, okay?
Okay.
The quarterback, Lynn Dickey, Lynn took defeat very hard. And so he's talking to people, packing his bag. And there was a broadcaster from the fledgling sports station, ESPN at the time. And the guy was like 30 feet away practicing his voiceover in an extremely loud voice. I kind of remember this. And the gist of his report was why the Packers passing game had just 8 touchdown passes after 7 games. Dickey yelled at the man, telling him to keep quiet. There was no response, so he raised his voice and finally got his attention. "Why don't you go out in the snow and say that stuff," Dickey said. "We don't need to hear that over and over and over again." So it was a hot locker room and a cold night, but it was a game never to be forgotten.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, let's move on to the closing here. We'll take some of your questions, and let's see what we've got.
All right, Mike, let's go to some questions here. We got one from Christopher Schmidt, and Chris asks, who are the biggest surprises and disappointments in the first 6 games?
Well, I think the biggest surprise for me is Demarius Randle, and not because I thought necessarily that he would be a poor player or, you know, struggle through his rookie season, but I've just been so impressed with the way he handles the amount of playing time he gets for a guy who is not a natural corner his whole life. Remember, this is a guy that played safety. So he moves to corner, he plays a ton in the nickel package, he plays a ton in the dime, and the kid never seems to get scared of any moment. His eyes never seem to widen. And the biggest disappointment for me, I would have to say it's Eddie Lacy, honestly. I think that, you know, he's a guy who, even when he was healthy, struggled to churn out yards. I think he had one good game against the Niners where he racked up 90. But other than that, I think he's really struggled. You know, who knows if there's something going on with the weight. He got injured, obviously. So I think the start to the season for Lacy has been a disappointment. All right, and then we've got one question here for Bob. This comes from Joe Pereth, I apologize if I pronounced that wrong. Joe wants to know, does Clay Matthews deserve Defensive Player of the Year consideration so far?
Definitely. He finished second to Troy Polamalu in 2010 when the Packers won it. Capers thinks it would have been a no-brainer had that vote been taken after the Super Bowl, not after the regular season. Consideration? Definitely for Matthews. He's doing it all.
I agree. I mean, to be able to harass quarterbacks the way he has from an inside linebacker position, I think speaks volumes about his quality as a football player, because there are a lot of guys who can rush off the edge and have success. There's not a lot of guys who can influence the game the same type of way, and perhaps even greater, you can argue, from an inside backer position. So I think if he continues to play this way and the Packers remain with a solid record, I think he's definitely going to be in that final voting.
All right, Mike, what are you doing in the bye?
What am I doing in the bye? Well, today is Wednesday, and I'm not sure if this is going to be posted on Wednesday or Thursday, but on Thursday, a cousin of mine comes in from Connecticut to visit me. He is my dad's nephew, and we're going to hang out in Green Bay for a few days, because when I got here, it was only 2 days before camp started, and I haven't even gotten a chance to really do much in and around the town since we work such crazy hours. How about you?
My good wife and I, she's agreed to let me go up to the UP and see a high school football game Friday night back on the blessed home grounds.
You're going to your high school?
No, my high school closed.
Really? I didn't know that.
45 years ago, right after I got out, year after.
Well, we can blame it on you.
Horrible disappointment. Go to a ball game, then hang out with friends in the old hometown.
How long of a drive is it up there?
2 hours.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Straight north?
Yeah.
Straight north. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, well, I think we've definitely exhausted our time here. We somehow managed to get past 50 minutes, even with no scouting report. There won't be a podcast next week. We're taking the week off. We decided to get one out of the way here, and then we can relax. So we will get back with you after the Broncos game. We'll see. We'll tell you all about Denver and see if this Packers team can remain undefeated. So until then, we thank you all for listening as always, and we'll talk to you soon.
Mortally on Russell. Enjoy.